Welcome, dear hunters, managers, and enthusiasts. This is Deer University, the podcast of the Mississippi State University Deer Lab. My name is Bronson Strickland.
And I'm Steve Damaris. Bronson and I are professors of wildlife management and co-directors of the MSU Deer Lab. Together, we've researched deer across the United States for more than 40 years. In our podcasts, we explain the why and how of deer management based on science, whether it's research we've conducted or explaining research done elsewhere. We'll offer you a college course in the science of deer management.
But don't let Steve scare you. This isn't going to be a review of calculus or chemistry. Instead, we take results of research, reduce it to what's important, and explain how you can apply research to management. So join us for this episode of Deer University. And today I have Mr. Dudley Phelps, who is a Trees for Wildlife extraordinaire. So Dudley is actually my go-to guy when I have questions about what trees, what varieties and species are best on the landscape for different wildlife species. He is a very trusted contact and helps me help people in terms of giving them the right advice for habitat management. So Dudley, wanted to welcome you to the podcast and thanks for joining us.
Glad to be here.
Well, Dudley, before we get going here, if you don't mind, give us a little bit about who is Dudley and what is Dudley all about.
Okay. Well, I came up here to Mississippi State to the squeaky halls of Thompson Hall about 10 years ago and did a bunch of stuff in forestry and wildlife. And when I was in dendrology class, which seems to be what I'm better at. You know, there's a lot of avenues you can take in this field, but I'm really good at identifying trees. Oaks are my favorite. Another student who happened to be working at Mossy Oak noticed that and said, "Hey, why don't you come take a look at this place?" And I went out to the nursery, and it was a brand new nursery. They had just gotten it from the bank, and it had been out of production for several years. Willow trees were growing up through the roof. Anyway, I've been there ever since, and we kind of built a way to grow what we think is a superior tree for wildlife, and it's grown by leaps and bounds, literally and figuratively.
How long have you been doing that, Dudley?
This is my 10th year.
Okay. And that is within the branch of Mossy Oak, it's Native Nurseries,
Native
right?
Native Nurseries, correct.
Okay. Well, Dudley, let's start out with some of the most common questions that I get. And probably 8 times out of 10, I call you or email you and make sure I've got my facts right on this. But why don't we start out with the need for mast? And so mast is what us forestry and wildlife people term kind of the fruit of the tree. Most people think of acorns as mast.
Yeah.
But within that category, we have hard mast, which are acorns, and chestnuts. We can talk a little bit about that. And then soft mast, crab apples, persimmons, pears, stuff like that. What I tell people, Dudley, by all means, I want to hear your perspective. I tell people, and I firmly believe it, and I think there's bounds of research to demonstrate this, is that a deer herd is built on habitat. Deer herd, of course, has to have cover. But in terms of food, if you look at a deer's life on an annual scale, most of the things that go in a deer's mouth, at least what they want to go in its mouth, is a plant, a broad-leafed plant that we would call a forb.
Correct.
And so that is the foundation. What is then the role of mast is I typically say that it is supplemental.
Absolutely.
It can be a big part. It can be a big help. But as deer biologists and managers, we don't want to build a deer herd just thinking about acorns. We want to build a deer herd based on forage, based on broadleaf plants. And then we supplement with soft and hard mast, typically
Absolutely.
In the fall and winter. Does that go against anything you believe or you have seen.
No. And, you know, to add to that, I've had folks call in and, you know, they want to fill their property up with oaks. Being that I'm technically a salesman, I'm not afraid to tell somebody, you know, you don't need that many trees.
Yeah.
You know, you know, food plots are really important. You know, what you do to open the canopy up to encourage more forbs and whatnot. That's all just as important. You know, there's a lot of people that live and hunt in the Ozarks. There's nothing but oak trees there, you know. In that scenario, a lot of times you may need to cut a lot of them down.
Right.
Specifically, you know, we were talking about this earlier, specifically the ones that don't produce as well. You may need to watch them for a few years and thin the herd. You know, mm-hmm. you can't really manage for antlers in the field, but you can manage for better genetics. So, and on that same note, you've got species that may not be indigenous to the area, like in the Ozarks, but they will grow great there. And some of them may drop earlier or later than what the indigenous oaks are. So,
mm-hmm.
you know, when your food plots are eaten to the ground or you have a harsh winter and you go out there one day and they're all yellow, it's nice to have something late dropping.
Right.
You know,
right.
I'm a big proponent of Schumard oak. It grows just about anywhere and it drops when there's not a whole lot of food around. So they have their place, but
mm-hmm.
they're not necessary.
So why don't we talk about, since you brought up Schumard oak, let's talk about some of the most common species and varieties that you have personally or people you've worked with have had the most success with. So why don't we start with, I'm a big bow hunter. I don't get to engage in the activity as much as I want to, you know, but if I could choose one weapon and one way to hunt, you know, for the rest of my life, I'd choose a bow. So I'm always thinking about bow season. I typically think of bow season as soft mast time of year. You know, that's going to be, depending on where you're at in the country, that's September, October versus November, December. What are your go-to varieties, or I say species first and maybe varieties on soft mast trees that will provide nutrition but are also going to attract in deer to facilitate observation and harvest?
Well, a lot of that depends on where you are in the country. Crab apples and apples are real popular, like in the Appalachians, the Ozarks, and further north, your traditional apple-growing regions. They can be a little bit disease-prone, so it is important to plant those where they have been known to survive and thrive. Once again, I'm not afraid to talk somebody out of growing something. Crab apples are great, but you need to put them in the right area.
And is that based on temperature, soil
moisture?
I
think it's more of like a humidity thing, and temperature. Fire blight can plague them. Scab can plague them. But wildlife nurseries also try to choose specific strains or varieties that are more disease or less disease prone. I'm also into tolerance. There's a big difference between tolerance and resistance.
What do you mean by that?
So, for example, some of the more common pear varieties in the South were traditionally chosen for canning, hard pears. The stuff you buy at the grocery store, the Bartletts, I'm not good at all those grocery store varieties, but they're soft pears. They're very prone to fire blight, especially in the South. Resistant means that it's not going to get something. It's not going to get that disease, or it's not going to get it badly. Tolerant means it can get the disease, but it can still produce a good crop, or it can still survive and thrive.
It can work through it.
Right. It can handle a disease load. I'm all about the tolerant varieties for wildlife. You know, I'm happy to help anybody if they want to grow something near the cabin.
Yeah.
You know, there's a good variety called Liberty. That's an apple variety. It's very disease resistant.
Mm-hmm.
You know, who wants to be spraying stuff every week when they could be, you know, doing something on their tractor or whatever, prepping a food plot.
So is it one of those trade-off things, Dudley, through the selection process where if you have found this variety that's resistant against some disease, that's fantastic, but you might be giving up another trait that would be advantageous? Is that...
You could. You know, could. Traditionally, fruits have been chosen to look good on the shelf or to store well. You know, not many... There hadn't been a lot of pioneering in the art of making selections for wildlife.
Okay.
But you can pick through those, and, you know, folks have planted a lot of them, and, you know, well, this one drops really late. You know, that may be a good wildlife variety.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and earlier we were discussing, you know, what works good in different parts of the country. I'm a big persimmon fan. I love the common American persimmon. Asian persimmons, they're made for home use. Asian persimmons were more made for home use. You have to pick them off the tree. They don't really fall on the ground. I'm a big fan of the Americans. They make smaller fruits, but they drop a lot of fruit. Whereas, you know, an Asian variety, one may fall out of it a day. So
is that the ones I'll see sometimes, this huge persimmon fruit?
It is.
Looks like a small apple.
And okay. You know, a lot of folks call in and they really want that to be a good wildlife variety. I'm a big persimmon fan. I have all of them. I like to pick them around the cabin and eat them.
Mm-hmm.
But if I'm planting for wildlife, I like the common ones.
And that means it's adapted for the temperature, environment, soils in the Southeast, too.
Exactly.
That's where it's from.
Then another one is pear. It can be overlooked. I really like it in the South, where it's a little bit harder to grow apples. There's some wild strains that are basically a generation or two removed from the domestic varieties like kefir. They're typically golf ball sized. They're tolerant to fire blight, meaning they can get fire blight but still produce a good crop.
Okay.
They don't require fertile soils. They don't require a lot of moisture. So that's a good one. Not to be confused with the Bradford or the Callery pear, which is becoming an invasive.
Yeah. I was going to ask you about that. The invasiveness of Bradford pear is becoming more and more and more of a problem. Timing-wise, Dudley, so those three species you just mentioned, so let's say you had a property where you could grow all three of those, a crabapple, pear, persimmon, what would be the timeline for when those fruits would mature and drop?
Well, one thing you've got to consider is is it grafted or is it a seedling variety? You know, when you plant seedlings, there's going to be a lot of variation. You know, you may order 10 seedling pears, and you may get some that drop in August, some September, some October. If you choose varieties that are grafted, you know, like kefir pear being a popular grafted variety, you know, it may drop all within a 3-week span at the end of September. So it's you know, real important, you know, when you call and talk to the person at the nursery, you know, ask for specific drop times, tell them where you're from. You know, back to the question, persimmons can also vary. You see a lot of them, a lot of individuals will drop all of their fruit in 1 week. You know, up north, it's usually in early to mid-September. Down here in the South, it's usually the first week or two in October. But then, you know, you can find standalones. You may find one on the corner of a field that decides to wait and drop all of its fruit in November. That's the kind of stuff I look for is the early, okay. the ones that stand out. that, okay, you know, they may drop early or they may drop late. I want to get those and put them in a seed orchard and in time try to make selections for varieties that drop outside of that normal time, because
yeah, then you can be strategic about using it.
Exactly.
Hunting wise. Yeah. Yeah. So Dudley, here's an ignorant question on my part, which is why I call you all the time. When you were talking about the grafted, is a landowner doing the grafting themselves, or are you saying, are they purchasing it already grafted?
I think a lot of folks are purchasing stock already grafted.
Okay.
I would like to see something we chose to do as a nursery was to try to educate everybody. When you're running a business, you don't want to teach everybody how to grow oaks at home, or at least that makes sense. But I kind of work the other way. I think if folks are engaging themselves, they're going to learn more. They're still going to buy a product from me and other nurseries, but mm-hmm. They're going to be more interested in it. They're going to want to go out there and do more. So
they make a hobby of it.
I've got a video mm-hmm. on YouTube on how to graft.
Okay.
So you can buy seedlings for cheaper that aren't grafted and grow them for a couple of years, get some girth on them, and then come back and graft them yourself. So you may find a persimmon tree somewhere on the back 40 that doesn't drop until the rut. You know, how magical would that be? And then go cut some little branches out of it in February, sticking them in a baggie and put them in your fridge. And that next turkey season, put a few of them in your vest. You know, nothing's gobbling. Go finish the afternoon off by grafting 20 persimmons. And you can even put them strategically in areas, you know, based on what the thermals do up near this little creek or near this saddle. And, you know, when you're laying in bed at night, you can be thinking about places you want to put those trees.
It's as simple as that.
It is.
I'm sitting here envisioning, I thought you had some type of surgery you were having to conduct. You could literally they're not gobbling this morning, so I'm going to head out and the materials that you could carry in your pockets and in your vest, you could graft some trees.
Absolutely.
Wow. Yeah, I got to learn more about that.
Yeah.
That's interesting. Okay, staying on the soft mast, what are your go-to varieties? If you don't know anything about a property, someone calls you and they're from Georgia, South Carolina, Louisiana. They don't know anything about the soil. What their absentee landowner or lessee type person, what do you think is the most durable species? If I had to pick one, man, 9 times out of 10, if you plant this, it's going to work. I'm guessing that's not going to be crabapple.
Probably not.
Persimmon or pear?
Persimmon or pear would be good, especially in the southeast.
Okay.
And we can talk about some northern varieties. I like to include everybody, but persimmon, you can find them growing up on top of a ridge on a fence row. I'm sure it was a raccoon dispersed seed that sprouted, mm-hmm. and because it was on a fence line, it made its way up through and found plenty of sunlight. And it can just be the poorest, driest, eroded hilltop, and there's a persimmon making fruit every year. They'll even tolerate, you find them when you're duck hunting. Mm-hmm. You see that alligator skin looking bark when you're riding your boat through the flooded timber. So they can even handle seasonal flooding. So it is a site plastic species. Pears are much the same way, except they can't handle the wet feet quite as much. But
okay.
it's a good species to grow that can tolerate most conditions. Doesn't require a lot of fertility, doesn't require a lot of soil moisture, and still grows like a weed.
So you got me wondering about something. You know, we started out talking about oaks, and sometimes you reference the Ozarks, and that could be a lot of places where it's a whole stand is composed of hardwoods and oaks and the need to manage that. Okay, so you have identified you're riding along and you see that persimmon. And the canopy, though, is currently being reduced. You might have a loblolly pine beside it or a water oak beside it, whatever. But you notice that that tree is dropping. But the canopy isn't that developed. Would you then also go in and manage cut down some of the trees around that persimmon to facilitate the canopy growth, which you would assume would then produce more fruit?
Absolutely.
Okay.
You know, you got to think about its roots, and then you've got to think about getting it more sunlight. So by taking out that cedar next to it that just drinks so much water and takes up so much root space, you know, it's almost the equivalent of being able to go in.
Right.
It's almost the equivalent of being able to go in there and water it. You know, you're taking away, or you're adding that much more moisture to your tree. And the same with sunlight, especially on the south facing side. You know, the sun always leans to the south every day.
Mm-hmm.
It absolutely helps. And while you're there, why not lay those trees on the ground to kind of direct traffic, so to speak, if you were going to hang a stand?
Yeah. Yep. There's a lot of strategy, a lot of stuff going on right now. Of course, the people talking about hinge cutting, you know, and you can hinge cut for cover. You know what, Marcus and us at the Deer Lab, we're into, you know, the mineral stumping, you know, just getting those stump sprouts. But then what do you do with the tree? Well, heck, you can use the tree to establish cover, or like you mentioned, why don't you steer them to a fruit tree, to a stump or something like that? That makes for a good opportunity. Before we get into the hard mass, I want to cover oaks and chestnut. What time do you plant, Dudley? So they've made a decision. I want to plant persimmon and pear or maybe crabapple. My understanding is that right now, February, March, would be the ideal time.
It is.
Okay.
Here in the South, that is the ideal time. In the South, and we're talking about bare root and containerized, your window is a little bit wider when you're dealing with containerized stuff. Bare root has to be dug while it's dormant or in the very early spring. So your window is also a lot shorter. But with containerized plants in the South, I like to say that, you know, when the ground is wet for the winter, which is usually sometime in early December, you can start then and plant all the way into mid-March. With bare root, you kind of have to wait until nurseries are able to dig and start shipping seedlings, which usually begins sometime in February.
Okay.
And then it goes into early to mid-March.
And are you using spring green up as kind of that indicator of mid-March?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay.
And with containerized plants, a lot of you know, we've had really wet springs the last few years. So if you do some good site prep, you know, maybe spray a little circle of Roundup so that, you know, you're not having to dig through a lot of roots and whatnot. I've planted on into June before and been really successful, especially when you're pairing them with tree protectors, doing a little weed control and whatnot. But most years in the South, with containerized, December into earlier mid-March. With bare root, it's more like February into early March. Up north, you kind of have a split season. With containerized, you can fall plant, and then you pick up again in the spring. With bare root, it's generally just in the spring.
Okay.
So you get a little bit more rainfall in October up north. You're done planting your food plots. You can go get some trees in the ground during October, and they can start the rooting process. So you're buying drought insurance by fall planting. In the north, if you have to wait until May to plant, you know, wait till the ground thaws out, summer is right around the corner. So it may not have as much time to root in before that drought hits, and you may get stuck watering a little bit. So I try to encourage people up north to plant twice a year. You're mm-hmm. kind of mitigating your risk. Get some in the fall, and then pick back up again in the spring.
Okay. Great advice. I'm showing my southern bias here. I never thought about the fall planting. When I think of fall here, I think it's dry. October is the driest month, typically
it's
in the south.
It's one of the driest months, yeah. And you can plant then. Time it before. If you see something on the radar, order some plants, get them shipped. You may have to water them two or three times before that December rain mm-hmm. comes, and they'll be fine. You know, okay. They're trying to approach dormancy as well in the fall, so they don't require as many inputs at that time of the year. So you can gamble mm-hmm. a little bit and plant in the fall.
Tell me, Dudley, tell me about the mighty chestnut. And why don't you, if you don't mind, give everyone just a kind of a natural history, just a quick review.
Yeah.
It used to be a dominant tree species in the eastern U.S. And what happened to it?
Well, the American chestnut was a dominant species. I think it composed most of the forest, especially like in the Appalachians. Chestnuts, big poplars growing everywhere. Also a lot of oaks, you know, the forest burned a lot before we came over here and changed things. But in the early 1900s, I believe up in New York State, it was discovered, the blight. Mm-hmm. And it came from imported chestnut species from Asia and spread. And, you know, by the 30s and 40s, it was all the way followed the Appalachians south, and you know, I think by the 50s there pretty much weren't any chestnuts to be found. They were just sprouting from the stump, and they would sprout, flower, make some fruit, and then die back again, and then sprout again. And over time, they just lost all their energy. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, we humans brought that problem over here to the U.S. and you know, we can get into the native versus non-native maybe later, but the solution was to just, you know, plant the species that can tolerate the blight, which is the Asian and European varieties, mm-hmm. Japanese varieties. The American chestnut was more of a timber form. They were huge, grew, you know, bigger than oaks, faster than oaks. And the Asian varieties are more bred for commercial use or for human use, so they're much shorter. They have a big canopy. They can produce the nuts at the age of two or three, and they're a lot larger in size. They're not quite as sweet, but the deer don't seem to mind. You know, the nuts are easy to extract from that burr. Mm-hmm. It's a real spiny burr. Mm-hmm. Hard to get them out of there, but they seem to. You know, once again, they were bred for human use.
Yeah.
And so it's really a totally different species, despite what you may hear from some nurseries. You know, we're bringing back the chestnut. Well, they're really not. But it is a niche. Deer like them. They've proven to be a reliable source of mast. They've proven not to be an invasive species. So, once again, they're great to supplement with. I never recommend somebody filling up their 40-acre pasture with one species of non-native plant, but plant some corners and edges. You know, it's an early mm-hmm. dropper, so think bow season, you know, September, early October, even into mid-October. There's some selections that are dropping on into November. Mm-hmm. Some of the Auburn selections.
Okay.
And deer absolutely devour all of the chestnuts. And turkeys come behind them and pick up all the bits and pieces that got dropped. And it's a great human food source, too.
So I thought I had always heard over the years, I mean, I'm assuming plant breeders like yourself, aren't you trying to identify maybe that particular trait in the Asian and European varieties, and you're crossing that with the American. And so you're trying to hybridize, right, to where can we get the most of the American chestnut with that little trait buried in there that would give them the resistance to the blight?
Basically, yes. So, you know,
how would you say that's going, though?
It's going well. You've got the ACCF and the ACF, I believe, the American Chestnut Foundation and the American Chestnut Cooperators Foundation. They have a slightly different models of how they're going to bring back the American Chestnut. One of them is making selections from the American Chestnut survivors. The other is crossbreeding with the Asian varieties, and each generation they're making a selection for resistance. So they want it to phenotypically, which is they want it to look like an American chestnut, but that one gene, which is the blight resistance, they want that to remain. So I believe they're on the 17th generation now.
Wow.
One thing I've noticed is there's another disease, which is a type of root rot. It's hard to pronounce. Phytophthora cinnamononii or something like that. It's
gonna,
cinnamon
gonna
root
trust
rot.
Trust you on that.
Cinnamon root rot. And there wasn't a lot of selection made for that. So I think there's a little bit of backpedaling going on.
Okay.
Asian chestnuts can also get it. But
okay, so what would be if someone's looking to incorporate chestnut on their piece of ground today, any general characteristics they should look for and before purchasing?
I would just ask, you know, is the seed collected from an orchard of named varieties? You know, Dunstan is a popular name, Paragon, King, Colossal. You can plant grafted, you know, the orchardists that are growing these for production are planting grafted clones that produce better than the seedlings. A lot of the ones that you're getting in the wildlife industry are seedlings from those grafted orchards. The failure rate with grafted chestnuts is still relatively high. So I don't recommend planting grafted stuff for wildlife. The Auburn ones seem to be doing really well, but other than that, I would choose seedlings or the Auburn varieties. They still produce a lot of nuts. They grow fast.
Okay. Well, then what's left is the mighty oak, right? So that in terms of ecologically the niche when chestnuts – for the most part, left the landscape, that opened up the niche for oak in terms of mast, oak, hickory, and all that. What are your go-to species on the oak side? What do you see? And I know you've got such a diversity of different species.
Right.
So I imagine you can match an oak for just about every situation someone can present to you.
I get the question, what's your favorite? What's the best for deer? It could be one of any or, you know, many. And
it's like matching a clover. You got a pretty good number that you can match to the site.
And I'm a big fan of diversity. The main thing I ask somebody when they call is, you know, what's missing? Do you already have a lot of oaks? Do you not? You know, if you're a big hunter, do you prefer to bow hunt? Do you prefer to hunt early, late? There's so many variables. But one thing, you know, you don't want to repeat is if you already have a lot of white oaks on your place, you may not want to plant white oak. You know, what is the lowest hole in your bucket?
Mm-hmm.
You may want to plant some late droppers. I'm a big fan of stuff that drops after your local oaks are done. I keep coming back to Shumard oak. It'll grow just about anywhere. Zone 6 and south. We may get into zones later. USDA planting zones.
Right.
But what I like so much about Shumard is it grows fast. It's pretty site plastic, but the acorns usually drop late. So once they've eaten all the water oaks, all the cherry barks, all the white oaks, they're just starting to drop.
Generally, what time of year is that? Are you talking December?
We're talking starting late November and through December. you know, walking around here on campus, I will see Shumard oak still in the tree in February.
Mm-hmm.
And you'll have a little cold front, a little freeze and thaw action, and some wind, and it'll kick them out. Mm-hmm. Nuttall, which is a bottomland species, is even later. It doesn't even really think about dropping until around Christmas, which here is the peak of our rut.
Absolutely.
So, you know, once again, your food plot looks like a putting green. They are just starting to drop.
What about swamp chestnut?
That's a really cool species.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of us here in the South have a vivid memory of finding that swamp chestnut down on a creek bottom and hanging a stand and having a really successful hunt. They can be that oak that doesn't drop but every 4 years.
Okay.
Or every 5 years. And just like we were talking about earlier, you can find that magical one that drops frequently. At my nursery, I try to collect seed from frequent dropping chestnuts.
Mm-hmm.
or swamp chestnut oak.
Yeah.
And it's a favorite. It's in the white group, or it's actually called the white section. Large acorn, low tannin, deer devour them. And it's fun watching them eat them, because it's a real large acorn, and they've got to fit it in their mouth, and then they start chewing on the hull, and you hear this real loud popping noise, and then they chomp it up and go find another one.
I was lucky enough, on a lease I was on, within that bottom land, there was a group of white oaks, and within that group, 20 or 30 trees, one of them, or a couple, or most, you know, were always dropping, but relatively early. And then moved down the slope closer to the creek bank, and there were a couple of swamp chestnuts that were excellent producers, and they really didn't stop. They really didn't get going until mid-November.
Exactly. And, they're later than regular white oak.
So I always now keep an eye out for the swamp chestnuts.
No doubt.
Is there any difference in planting those trees versus the soft mass trees? Is it the same general this time of year, February, March? Any differences?
It is. Some of the fruit trees are a little bit more cold hardy. So folks up in the north, you know, they may want to get some apples and crab apples in the ground in the fall, because you never know, you may have a really harsh winter. If that may be the only difference.
Mm-hmm.
When they're young, oaks may not be quite as cold tolerant, so it may be best to reserve those to plant late winter, early spring. But no, as far as how to dig your hole and all that good stuff, there's not a lot of difference.
Okay. So one of the principles we preach around here in terms of a deer herd is managing your expectations and be reasonable. Despite everything you do, every buck is not going to be a Boone and Crockett. In fact, it follows a bell curve distribution, and there's outliers to the right, outliers to the left, and kind of what's the average. I hope I'm making a decent connection here, Dudley, but given that, when you start investing in a project, so I say starting this year and every year after here for the next 5 or 10 years, how many trees do you need to put on the landscape to kind of account for, there's going to be some good ones, there's going to be some bad ones, but 7 out of 10, 5 out of 10, 9 out of 10, what's kind of the going average of they're going to take hold, so to speak, grow, live, and start producing?
90% seems to be close to that number. If you're following, you know, what the protocol I preach with folks planting for wildlife is, you know, don't try to fill your place up with trees in 1 year. You know, maybe have a 5-year plan where you plant 20 trees a year. That way you have more time to baby or maintain each one of them. Use the tree protectors, do some weed control, fertilize them, you know, take a lot of time thinking about where you're going to put your trees. you know, protect them from hogs, all that good stuff, you can get about 90% survival at a spacing of about 35 feet on average with your larger trees, smaller fruits, more like 25 feet apart. And the 35-foot spacing is easy to remember because that's 35 trees per acre.
Mm-hmm.
Traditional forestry-type plantings, you're using a lot tighter spacings. You're accounting for poorer survival. With wildlife, you're planting fewer trees per year. You're going to spend a little bit more money mm-hmm. per tree, or maybe a good bit more money per tree. But 90% of the time, if you do what you're supposed to do, that is going to be a mature tree that's going to produce someday. And then from there, if you need to cull a few, you know, they're not all going to be awesome producers.
Right, right.
Even if you're planting stuff that is touted as, you know, genetically superior, you're going to have some individuals that don't get those traits and may need to be moved. If you're planting persimmons, half of them are going to be males.
Mm-hmm.
And so you may decide you want to cull some of those. You may want to keep them just for your pollinators.
Right.
But, 90% seems fair.
I'm sure you have gotten this phone call triple digit number of times. Someone planted whatever species variety of tree, and it comes, and maybe they did it in February or March, and then come July, August, September, they call you up and say, "What the heck, Dudley? What the heck? I did everything I thought you said to do, and they're all dead," or whatever. Most of them are dead. What I'm getting at is, what's the most common mistake you see people make, and they have poor survival, poor success? What are most people doing wrong that they're not thinking of?
I'm so glad you asked that. Planting your seedlings too deep is the main killer. With good intentions, you know, I want to dig some really good holes. I'm going to put that post hole digger on my PTO, and I'm going to go pre-dig all my holes. And so they do. And they put all the dirt back in the holes, or think they put it all back in there, plant your tree, come back 2 months later after some rain, maybe some freezes, and your tree is sunken 2 inches deep in that hole. A farmer does not plant corn at the bottom of the row. They plant it on top of the row for good reason. There's more aeration. The soil can draw the moisture up. So with more air and oxygen, there can be more life in the soil. There's more pore space to hold nutrients and whatnot. When a plant is sunken and it stays wet, it can't breathe.
Mm-hmm.
And it basically, the same thing happens as if it's not fed water.
Yeah.
It just wilts and dies. And so I always recommend folks, when you're digging your holes, borrow a scoop of soil from off to the side and add it to your hole, and then chop it up before you plant, especially if you're in heavy clays that are poorly drained. You know, sandy loams and things, you can get away with planting a little too deep because you have such good drainage.
It drains, yeah.
But that's usually the common problem.
What's the rule of thumb for how deep? If I'm putting my shovel in the ground, am I putting the shovel all the way down, you know, till I start seeing handle, or do you say 6 inches, 12 inches?
Well, what? You know, when I'm talking to just average Joe out there, I say dig 12 inches to make sure you get through any hard layers.
Okay.
But when somebody specifically says, "Hey, I've got a nicely drained sandy loam," there's not going to be a hard pan there.
Mm-hmm.
And by hard pan, I mean a restrictive layer that's either caused naturally or by repeatedly driving over it, repeatedly disking. It's like a thin concrete-like layer that a taproot cannot penetrate. So usually at about the 12-inch mark, you're going to have busted through that hard layer.
Okay.
So if you don't know if it's there or not, I encourage everybody just to go dig a few holes and see if it is. If not, you can almost use one of those little dibble bars or flat bars and just make a tiny little slit and put your tree in there and get down on your hands and knees and push the dirt around the roots and stand up and tamp it in with your foot a little bit. Move on to the next one.
Okay.
But it, you know, if it does have hard layers, you got to spend some extra time with it.
You mentioned a moment ago, I had a note, let's talk about fertilization. And what I wanted to start with that is, on the food plot side, you know, we preach soil test, lime, you know, get the pH. What are you doing on the tree planting side? Is it also as beneficial to get a soil test to see what you're working with?
I wouldn't say it's as beneficial. I think a lot of folks are doing soil tests on their food plots and can get a general, they're doing that already. So they can get a general idea of what they have to work with on their property. If you think you have an extreme, you know, there's a lot of places in Texas, in the prairie and the Edwards Plateau and whatnot, that can have pHs up in the mid eights, which can drastically limit what you can grow. So places like that, it's important to get your soil tested and know what you have to work with. More important than pH is drainage, you know, soil type, knowing what can grow there. Trees have evolved for millions of years without having to be limed or fertilized. A lot of these designer strains of food plot species, they need a little bit more attention. They need more help. They're not going to survive in the wild without that perfect pH. Whereas, you know, an oak, you have a pH of 4.8, that's nothing to them.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
they're
some
used
of
to
the fruit trees,
that.
Apples, and whatnot, you may want to put some lime on it, but generally, no, it's not nearly as important.
Okay. Well, Dudley, of something I think about, a question I get a lot, and I think it's a real big consideration for someone that is leasing land versus owning land. It's a big consideration. Am I on an annual lease with the landowner, or do I have a kind of a 5 to 10 year window and commitment? Is trees aren't food plots. Food plots, even your perennial, it's still perennial food plots. It's still an annual kind of thing.
Exactly.
You can recover. Even if I planted some perennial food plots and I lose my lease in 2 years, I'm going to recover from that. Is there a situation where if you knew or thought, hey, I got a 5 year window, would it be worth the investment to maybe go with the soft mass, to go with your persimmons, pears, crab apples? Would you start seeing the quote unquote the fruit, pun intended?
I think you can. You know, once again, I'm being the salesman, I'm supposed to tell you, yeah, sure. But, you know, you may want to buy some larger stock, some grafted fruit varieties that may almost already be producing for some, you know, I like to think of some of these as like a chip shot bow spot. You know, if you need to kill a couple of does, you know, plant some apples or crab apples, maybe get some larger ones that are already producing. Put them in strategic locations. Chestnuts can produce and start producing in 2 or 3 years, but it's still on a small tree. You know, maybe year 8 or 9, you'll really get to drawing things in, sawtooth oak. A lot of it depends exactly on how long you think that lease is going to last. If you don't have a 10-year agreement, I would scale it down, focus more on food plots and habitat. You know, getting permission to burn or whatnot, do a little TSI. Mm-hmm. And you know, there really isn't a silver bullet for that unless you're willing to purchase some larger stuff, plant fewer things. You know, mulberry is great. It can produce in 2 or 3 years and drop really early. It would be something good to get camera photos with, but not necessarily hunt over because it drops in the spring.
Turkeys would like that too, wouldn't they?
Yeah, they would. Mm-hmm. But I'm supposed to tell you yes, but you know, there's a happy medium, and I think it just involves buying a few larger trees.
Okay. You kind of answered my question. It doesn't make my question near as informative. You know, I was about to say, is there a rule on the soft mass side that, give or take outliers here and there, you know, are you looking at a 5-year window? But if I understood you correctly, that's a, it depends. Did you do bare root stock, or did you plant something, a tree that's older and developed and grafted? It all depends on what you're putting in the ground relative to the expectations of when fruit
exactly.
is going to fall.
Okay. You know, and then if you're willing to negotiate and get that extension, you know, maybe you've been there 3 or 4 years and the landowner has grown to trust and you want to, hey, let's ask for a 10-year plan. By all means, stick some chestnuts and Schumards and stuff in the ground.
That would be a good testament to you are investing in the landowner's property as well.
Yeah.
That might facilitate a longer lease right there. Okay, Dudley, well, I'm sure we missed something, but I think, at least from my perspective, those are a lot of the questions I've gotten over the years and hopefully ones you have received as well. Any last thing, Dudley?
No, not really. Other than if folks want to contact me, I'd be happy to talk. I talk trees all day. I absolutely love it. I can't think of doing anything different. So my name is Dudley Phelps. My email is dphelps@mossyoak.com. Or you can call me at the office, 662-494-4326.
Well, Dudley, I cannot tell you how much I appreciate it, and I'm sure I speak for all the listeners. They appreciate it, too. This is a really hot topic, and good, reliable information is what is needed. So thanks a bunch.
Yeah, thank you. Glad to be here.
Thank you, everyone, for listening, and we'll catch you next time on Deer University. We're glad you joined us today and hope you learned something valuable about deer management. If you have questions about this podcast or a question about a topic we haven't discussed, please log on to msudeerlab.com, click on the Deer University tab, and send us your questions. We'll get to them as soon as possible. In closing, we want to thank our employers, the Mississippi State University Extension Service and the Forest and Wildlife Research Center. We also want to thank the St. John and Dudley Hutchinson families for their endowments that support deer research and education.